And welcome to Blunt Business on CannabisRadio.com. Thank you for joining us. Listen to the program. Appreciate all of you joining me here, wherever you find the podcast, at CannabisRadio.com, the Cannabis Radio app, or on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, YouTube Music, all other platforms. Thank you again for making time. This week on the program, we're going to go ahead and talk about the tax breaks that were talked about a lot more extensively when it comes to what rescheduling cannabis will do and how it can equate to over $2 billion in tax revenue coming back to the cannabis industry, according to estimates. We're going to go through that in just a moment. And also various studies that are going on right now talking about where states have adult use cannabis, that opioid use is falling, which is wonderful. They're going to see. And then also other studies that are coming out when it comes to the cannabis usage for middle age, older adults, and how it's helping with larger brain volume and better cognitive function. So studies that are being done out there, we're learning more about all this every day. It's wonderful to go and see. So here we are. Westward puts out a great story here. Sloan Speck, want to give a shout out and make mention of how they have a story called Rescheduling Cannabis Could Bring Tax Breaks and Quiet Deregulation. So we've talked a lot about what this means about the scheduling under the Controlled Substances Act from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. We've talked about it ad nauseum. And one of the things I kept pointing out as a caveat that people would be very well aware to see as a benefit, one of the biggest benefits for rescheduling cannabis would be the tax breaks, the IRS Section 2, Revenue Code Section 280E being removed because cannabis would no longer be distinguished as the kind of narcotic that would be under Schedule 1 that would still be taxed on heavily as it is. So here's what we got. In the tax breaks, we have here this story that explains that when it comes to the business taxes, that would be one of the biggest reliefs for all legal cannabis businesses in the states that host them. It's more about business taxes, not doing more, raising more revenue, but creating incentives that shape how companies organize and operate. That rescheduling would relax implicit restrictions, serving as a quiet form of deregulation that removes tax pressures currently shaping the industry's financing, structure, and compliance. And rescheduling would cut taxes, but also remove the government levers over an industry that's been principally regulated by states. So they go through how tax rules shape what businesses do and the social effects of changing those rules. So businesses can deduct, write off ordinary or necessary expenses. So if a business wants to subtract the costs of rent and utilities from the income they earn, it's not the case for businesses that deal in Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 controlled substances. Legal cannabis businesses pay federal income tax on their gross income rather than net income. And that's the big difference right there. So when they calculate here that gross income versus net income could be, let's say, a 21% tax rate, and then the cash profits would be a healthy net profit margin. And if this cannabis industry set up now in the current state before rescheduling, Section 280 of the Internal Revenue Code would deny any income tax deductions for expenses. And the rule applies even though expenses are real costs, the business is under legal under state law, but businesses would owe in tax on gross income, and that would put business in the red, negative cash flow, negative net profit margin. So they go down and investigate a little bit here, a little more research, that there's two court decisions that handed down these kind of decisions where the Supreme Court held that income from illegal activities remains subject to tax. This is going back to the tax evasion charges of Al Capone in 1931. 1981, U.S. Tax Court affirmed that illegal activities were taxable on their net income after deductions, like legal businesses. And then the following year, Section 280E was enacted by lawmakers. But Schedule 3 would tax legal cannabis businesses like other businesses and would better align with federal law, according to advocates, with widespread state-level legalization of cannabis. Rescheduling could equate to a tax break of about $2.3 billion for the cannabis industry, according to one estimate. And imagine what other states will then fall in line and green light cannabis, or they don't. Because at the moment, 40 states so far are medical, 24 are still in the same shape when it comes to adult use, with more states going the green light very soon. Then they also talk about the fact that there's regulatory effects to Section 280E that would go away once rescission comes in. And we're not here to go ahead and discuss or dispute when this is going to happen. We're already seeing stories out there that think, oh, this is going to take a year. It's going to take longer. It might be after President Trump is out of office. We don't know. Listen, it's what's important now is to know that we have this directive that started back to the Biden administration. Now coming full circle here. It's time to see if we get things ready as we're in tax time right now, to go ahead and see what the benefits are going to be, because for projecting the future investments or projecting future revenue, we need to go ahead and see what this means for everybody out there. It's important to go through this information. Constraining after-tax profits and cash flow, status quo makes it harder for cannabis businesses to finance growth internally using their own money from operations, retained earnings, and this scarcity can help explain the mature legal cannabis industry's low rates of year-over-year growth. Right. They can't quote the growth and they can't do anything more. Think about these publicly traded companies that, of course, they're struggling to go ahead and really keep, you know, a really consistent price on their ticker because they can only show so much growth. And I mean, think that the federal government and what they do to constrain on that. I mean, there's not that many investors or any speculators that are still going to still give the benefit of the doubt because they understand how cannabis is being regulated, that their books are going to say otherwise. But if they could show the net, they could go and just be able to be taxed on net income, that revenue is going to be shown. Like, that's the other part too. How many companies will decide to go ahead and then go public after rescheduling so they can show themselves with the revenue that they have? Now they can actually show stats that are going to be very favorable to them for more shareholders to jump on board. The other thing they talk about is that for legal cannabis businesses, the constraint is for growth through external and often unconventional funding sources, right? The banking system. We know about the issues when it comes to the taxing on gross income. Same thing going with the banks and public capital markets, treating legal businesses as off limits or high risk. So businesses like cannabis would have to turn to private capital for loans, specialized leasing arrangements and equity investments, and the restrictions private investors, the ones that we know that, you know, I go back, what, 7-8 years ago, I talked about that episode on the Green Peak with Richard Zwicky, where he talked to Stephen D'Angelo, and he said that in California, Silicon Valley, there are investors waiting to jump in, but they're not going to jump in on this high-risk environment, but they're waiting in the wings. And the federal restrictions also, private investors will scrutinize transactions closely, insisting on protective covenants and operational restrictions. And Section 280E also encouraging legal cannabis businesses to isolate activities that don't touch the plant from cannabis production and sales. And if the activities are truly separate, they can claim business expense deductions that direct cannabis-related activities cannot, which is why we always know, how many companies have we talked to on this program and on grassroots marketing before that would make the point that they're not a plant-touching business? So if they're doing the machinery or if they're doing the AI technology, whatever it is, those companies can really thrive. And that's why those companies have done well with growth over the years, except for the ones that are growing plants right now and trying to do the best with it. Like, imagine the difference that they had that or not. And they also go ahead and conclude here that Section 280 raises the stakes of accurately accounting for cannabis sold by businesses, because courts have affirmed that legal cannabis businesses can reduce their gross income by cost of goods sold. And under Section 280E, the businesses can also subtract the cost to grow, process, and package from their sales revenue. So businesses can meticulously monitor direct production costs throughout their supply chains. So working the system to show that they, whatever it takes to go ahead and let Section 280E apply. Imagine if you didn't have to go through this kind of red tape, and that companies, if they wanted to go ahead and reduce their gross income by cost of goods sold, now they just want to not worry about trying to reduce gross income. If they just know they're going to get taxed on net income, biggest difference. That's what we're all waiting for. Many state regulatory regimes already require inventory tracking, enter metric, and others like that. Section 280E adds a financial reward for rigorous documentation, controls, and auditing. Right, we would actually get more compliance. And I would imagine more companies would be on board with compliance as a result of this. Now, some of the tax compliance work is mere paper shuffling, but public policy may favor multiple forms of regulation by multiple stakeholders. A diversity of oversight for an industry where lapses or inconsistencies can have serious social costs. Wouldn't that be great? There would be more incentive for compliance if we don't have to go through the work of trying to go and work around in the accounting circles of reducing gross income by cost of goods sold. And more importantly, allowing investors to actually put capital in without having to worry about high risk and any kind of distinction, because it's like a scarlet letter on a company when they have to deal with that. They also talk about the fact that the debate over rescheduling is also about more than just tax normalization versus public health risks. The other question can be raised here is whether the federal government should yield one of its most practical points of leverage over the legal cannabis industry and whether another regulatory mechanism should replace it. We've talked about that. Could it be the DEA? Could it be the FDA? We don't know. But we know there are particular compliance tools in place or measures that have been done, good manufacturing practices when it comes to cannabis, or the Cosmetics Act of 1930 when it comes to hemp. Like, it's time to go and get all this rectified. Now, one of the things that we're going to be talking about on an upcoming episode is we will be talking about the Georgia hemp ban. We'll be talking with someone that's on the ground there extensively about what's been happening about that and just go through the hemp ban itself pretty extensively. We're going to be doing that coming up on an upcoming episode. So get ready for that. Meantime, we're going to go to commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk about various studies to the benefit, to the positive of cannabis from the likes of Boston University. We'll talk about all that coming up after a short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Wilton Business on CannabisReader.com. A study, according to Boston University, is finding that daily opioid use fell 9 to 11 points after adult use cannabis legalization. By the way, I try to avoid reading marijuana or recreational when it comes to these stories. So if I stumble a little bit when I'm reading these stories, that's why, because I always like to be consistent with saying cannabis and adult use. You know, ask, you know, Bethany Moore. She's the first person that actually kept referring to the terms as such, and I just followed along with that. I thought it was just the right way to go. So a new study led by Boston University School of Public Health that legalizing cannabis for both medical and adult use may lead to a decline in daily opioids among people who inject drugs in the United States. This is in the Journal of Drug Alcohol Dependence that they saw a 9 to 11% point decline in daily opioid use among the population among those states that legalize cannabis for medical use. There's still debates about harms and benefits of cannabis use. We can, of course, that gets out there more than the stories like this. But of course, on this program, we're actually trying to go and talk about what's the actual criticism, the actual constructive criticism, the true effects, what we're really learning out there. We either get the information out there to people, then try to go ahead and paint some negative narrative out there that everybody else does in the media. So because of the potential advantage of widespread access to cannabis, it would enable people to substitute their use of the unstable and toxic opioid supply with safer cannabis, lowering chances of experiencing opioid-related harms or dying from an overdose. Opioids contribute to more than 75% of fatal drug overdoses. Think about fentanyl. Think about what else is out there, cocaine, whatever it might be. People who inject drugs are part of a population that's the epicenter of the opioid crisis in America and would stand to benefit the most from policies that increase access to cannabis. Yeah, more natural products. Of course there would be. They talked to Dr. Danielle Haley, assistant professor of community health services at the Boston University School of Public Health. Quote, the magnitude of decrease in opioid use we observed among the population is experienced with opioid use and likely to experience unpleasant withdrawal symptoms after reducing this use is very profound and important. So helping them wean off of this, not a methadone clinic that you'd see on TV. No, nothing like that. Dr. Haley and her colleagues, they utilized data from the CDC and Prevention's National HIV Behavioral Surveillance that included self-reported use of cannabis and non-medical opioid use within the last year among 29,000 people who inject drugs, comparing data from states that did not legalize cannabis, legalized for medical use, or for both. And the data spanned 13 states in four ways. They looked over four different years, 2012, 2015, 2018, and 2022. The decline was equivalent across all racial and ethnic groups, as well as males and females. Dr. Leo Beletsky, a co-author of this study and professor of law and health and sciences at Northeastern University, says that this study adds to a growing body of evidence that sensible changes to our outdated drug policies can have a positive health impact, especially among some of our most vulnerable neighbors. They didn't look at the links between legalization and daily cannabis use, but cannabis use did increase by 5 percentage points among participants living in states that transitioned from legalizing to medical use. And then Stephen Murray, an adjunct clinical assistant professor for community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health, an overdose survivor and former paramedic with expertise in overdose prevention. He wasn't involved in the study himself, but he did say, quote, "The study shows is the potential impact of decriminalization paired with access to a regulated supply. When legal barriers are removed and people have safer alternatives available, we see meaningful reductions in daily opioid use, even among people with long histories of injection drug use." That's a powerful signal. That is big news. Glad to go and see that as well. Another study coming out, New York Post reports this, that researchers are surprised by the brain benefits of cannabis usage in adults over 40. So New York Post puts this out there, but I also want to take this from the University of Colorado Anschutz that actually put this out here as well. So a new study from Colorado University's Anschutz researchers, they looked at population-level impacts of cannabis usage on the brain in older adults. Talked to Anika Guha, PhD, clinical psychologist, faculty research associate, Department of Psychiatry at the university. Quote, "More older adults are using cannabis, is more widely available, and it's being used for different results or different reasons than the younger folks for sleep and chronic pain. Plus, people are living longer. We have to be asking, what are the long-term effects of cannabis use as we continue to age?" So they looked at older adults with larger volumes in several brain regions and better cognitive function in adults between 40 and 77. And Guha was surprised by the extent of the positive findings, but cannabis use studies are difficult with often unknown variables, known constituents, and potency of the cannabis products. Study subjects where use were unknown. So here's the main points they got out of this. Research found that larger brain volumes and better cognitive function among middle-aged and older adults who use cannabis, especially in moderate-use cases. The areas of the brain studied include learning and memory, processing and speed, attention and executive function, and thought of at odds with cannabis consumption. And then another brain region saw lower volumes, suggesting cannabis on the brain is complex and nuanced, requiring further investigation. Well, let's bring on the studies. Let's bring on the research. More and more could be done every day. We would love to see more of that. They looked at a study of over 26,000 participants aged 40 to 77, average age 55, generally associated with larger brain volumes and better cognitive function. Also asked if there were any sex differences, because they said that they were saying here that men and women tend to use cannabis differently. They have different patterns of use and they report different subjective effects. And from the preclinical research, there's evidence that the endocannabinoid system is different in men and women. So the density of cannabinoid receptors differs and there seem to be complex interactions with hormones. But no clear-cut or consistent pattern that cannabis users for males always showed more favorable effects than women, and that they did see significant interactions across several brain regions and cognitive measures that suggest that sex is something that we need to be looking at because it seems to be an important factor. So let's get more research out there. This is important. Let's see if there's more to go and be said. So this is all good news. We like to see this here across the board, from the health benefits to the financial benefits of cannabis. That is something that's very important, and we should see more of this, more to talk about this. So this is great news. And that's what I'm here to go ahead and spread along. And now, next week, we will continue to go and bring on guests like we have always done here on Blunt Business to start focusing on these important stories and not just me ranting along about it. From time to time, I might still do some of these monologues here for all of you, but we're going to get back to guests once again. So I'm looking forward to that and can't wait to go and start bringing some of the best here, the best minds and the best experts in cannabis, and those that are also just on the ground that can give us a whole lot of takeaways. Can't wait to go and share all that with you coming up, starting next week with guest interviews here on Blunt Business, CannabisRadio.com. Thank you for listening in, and we'll talk to you next time.
Honestly, I put off building a website way longer than I should have. Then I tried Wix Harmony, and it was way easier than I expected. I just described what I wanted, and I had an incredible-looking website. The best part? I could change anything myself or ask my AI agent for help. I had everything my business needed right there. So, if you've been procrastinating, this is your sign. Start building a website for free at wix.com/harmony.